This is Audible.
ISIS Audiobooks presents an unabridged recording of Behind the Scenes at the Museum of Baked Beans, written by Hunter Davis. Read by Richard Burnip. The moral right of the author has been asserted. This performance is owned by ISIS Publishing Limited. Introduction. I've often had this fantasy of opening a museum. All collectors, big and small, old and new, rich and poor, have been struck at some time in the night or the half-awake day, or after a particularly long lunch, by this mad notion. It's a human weakness, a natural desire to share or display one's pleasures. Some collectors fall so in love with their own collections, spend so much time and energy and thought on them, that one day they think, I know, why not reveal my private passion to the outside world? Wouldn't the world be very pleased? Why be selfish? Let others enjoy what I have enjoyed. It can, of course, disguise other, baser motives, such as the desire to show off. Look at the treasures I have collected, clever old me. I have created something unique and wonderful and spent a fortune in the process. Oh yes, it hasn't been cheap. And now the world will see what a cultured and knowledgeable and wealthy person I am and, if I create my own museum with, of course, my name on it, the world will be bound to admire me forever. This is what oft happens at the top end, with mega plutocrats from America to Russia, with dictators and presidents. But it can also creep into the mind of the more ordinary, humble, everyday collector. You've got to the stage when your collection seems to be taking over your life, your house, spilling out of every crevice, drawer and wall of your home and of your brain. You are getting fed up with all this stuff, though not as much as your loved ones are. What can you do with it? Where is it all going? What is the point? You've probably by now accumulated enough rubbish to open your own museum. Hey, that's an idea. Never thought of that before. Should this notion ever enter your head, for whatever reason, then it is obvious what any sensible, rational person should do. Ignore it. Well, it is mad, isn't it? Who would want to turn a part-time amusement into a full-time occupation? We might love our own little bits and pieces, but deep down, most of us are aware they are puny, piddling. Loads of people must be bound to have much better examples. So who on earth would want to come and look at our stuff, even for free, even if we paid them? Collectors know, only too well, that on the whole we are alone. The vast majority of people in our day-to-day lives seem to be totally disinterested, if not actively antagonistic, to the things that we find so fascinating. This always comes as a sad realization, but it has to be admitted and faced, if only to spur us on, damn it, what do they know? What do they care? I'll show them. On the other hand, there are loads of us out there doing similar things, thinking similar thoughts. I'm always surprised by how many people are collectors, who have themselves got little collections tucked away or just things they have not yet thrown out. It's estimated that a third of the population in the UK are collectors, and in North America and Europe, for collectors tend to be thickest in the developed world for obvious reasons. Hard to find money to buy a penny black if your daily struggle is to afford a penny loaf. That means that some 20 million people in the UK must be collectors of some sort. The popularity of the Antiques Roadshow, of eBay or car boot sales does suggest that there are millions of us. This apparent contradiction, that there are millions of other collectors, we are in fact not alone, yet people seem not to be interested in my stuff, can be seen as a challenge. Obsessive collectors do tend to be interested mostly in what they themselves collect. In fact, they have to be single-minded to carry on. But surely the majority of people tuning into Antiques Roadshow are willing to be interested in anything that is, interesting, however you define it. I know I am. I honestly do love other people's collections almost as much as my own, regardless of the subject, amount, or value. Collecting used to be the preserve of the rich and powerful, of emperors and popes, kings and lordlings, who acquired gold and silver, precious objects, statues and ornaments, paintings and pottery, holy relics, or what are often referred to simply as antiquities, often by stealing, then putting them on display to show how rich and powerful they were. By around the 17th century, well-off gentlemen had started to arrange their more modest collections in their own homes, creating what they called a cabinet of curiosities. Natural history collections became very popular amongst ordinary folks as well as scientists and geologists, with people collecting fossils, shells, birds' eggs, plants, insects. In the 19th century, with the urban wealth created by the Industrial Revolution, large-scale exhibitions were mounted, such as the Great Exhibition of 1851, which inspired collectors big and small, and was followed by the creation of many of our famous provincial museums in major metropolitan centres, such as Liverpool in 1851, Nottingham in 1878. In London, the British Museum was established in 1753, the National Gallery in 1824, and the V&A in 1852. We now appear to be in something of a postmodern period. Collecting has become open, democratic, eclectic. You don't have to follow what has gone before. You can create your own unique collection. Or what you think is unique, but it usually turns out that someone somewhere has thought of the same thing, whether it's airline sick bags, mobile phones, or baked beans, which you thought were really off-the-wall mad ideas, till you find there's already an airline sick bag society and a mobile phone group, each with their own meetings, magazines, committees, and rows. For once collectors gather together, clashes appear. Take baked beans, for example. I like to think that on my journey, I am going to visit the world's first collector of baked beans, with his very own museum. But I know the moment I have written that sentence, which I just have, "See it burning bright in 10-point galliard," that someone will be jumping and saying, "I was first, I was miles ahead. Baked beans, that was my idea. Come and visit me instead." There are no rules anymore. You can collect anything you like, and, if you're daft enough, open your own museum to celebrate your own individual passion. And this is what is happening more and more often in Britain today. Our big national and municipal museums and galleries are world-famous, brilliant, amazing, awesome. How can any individual mortal compete? Yet, all the time, ordinary people are having a go in their own ordinary, eccentric, modest ways. And this is one of the reasons why I still find myself thinking, despite myself, that if they can do it, why can't I? Why keep all my collections to myself? I collected, as a child, the usual things, stamps, marbles, comics, cigarette packets, swapping and scavenging, rather than actually paying money, though relations might buy me a packet of assorted stamps and a cheap album from Woolies at Christmas time. I loved the collecting process, seeing how many I could get, and I also loved looking at them. When I had asthma and was lying in bed wheezing, I found that turning over the pages of my stamp album, thinking of all the countries I'd scarcely heard of and never expected to visit, took my mind off my ailments when all medications had failed. Half an hour later, I would get up, my breathing back to normal. Oh, there is a lot to be said for the therapeutic properties of collecting, and perhaps even looking at other people's collections, as we shall discover. I gave it up as a teenager, went on to other more exciting things like life, work, family, home. But then suddenly, in my 40s, I found myself returning to collecting. I became a born-again collector, which I now know is a fairly well-observed phenomenon, and started madly, wildly, excitedly on a collecting odyssey, which so far has not left me. During those fallow years, when I had not apparently been a collector, not apparent anyway to myself, I had in fact still been an accumulator, never knowingly going out and collecting, but never knowingly or willingly throwing anything out. So, when I came back to collecting, I found I had squirreled away various things, such as letters from prime ministers I had interviewed in the course of my work, which I then decided to expand, to go out to seek and find other examples at car boots, stalls, auctions, fairs. The result today is that I have 20 or so different collections on different topics, though along the way I have dumped a few things which I grew sick of or furious with or disappointed by for various reasons, which we might come to. I used to dream of being rich enough to buy a house with 20 rooms, so I would have a different room for each of my 20 collections, or perhaps a second house, and keep that purely for my collections. Beatrix Potter did something similar with Hilltop. She kept that as a sort of museum, using it from time to time, while doing her actual living with her husband in another house nearby, Castle Cottage. I do have two houses, as we divide each year in half between London and the Lake District, working away in each place, and my room in each is filled with my stuff, and the hall, and the bathroom wall, and any other spaces I can get away with, but I still have too much stuff stuffed away that I never look at, and no one else sees. I'm sure they would like to, so I still think, when that daft old fantasy rears itself once again. Is it too late? Is it really a nonsense? I'm fascinated by all the people who have created their own museums, turning their daft dreams into reality. How did they do it, and why? Was it just to share their passion, or are they driven by other complicated motives that I can't yet imagine? So, I decided to set off round Great Britain in search of mad museums. I use the term mad because that is so often how others see such people, as eccentric, obsessive, weird, and their collections as potty, pathetic, pointless. Viewpoints I would never express, and attitudes I certainly don't share, for I understand too well the strange compulsion to collect. I wondered, as I set off, if I would learn more about myself and my own passions by talking to them. If there would be patterns, common denominators, or would they turn out to be a random bunch who just happened to have ended up running museums? By mad museum, I mean something specific, a museum devoted to just one subject, one single topic. That is the vital distinction. Otherwise, it's a gallery of assorted items, a collection of collections, which is how most museums have traditionally been organised. There are loads and loads of them, all over the world, in every little town. A mad museum must be more or less unique. Okay, I know a thing is either unique or it's not. Most of the museums I plan to visit most definitely are. My other object is to seek out, where possible, the person who is or was the original creator of this mad museum, the guiding spirit. I'm hoping that in as many mad museums as possible, I will find the only creator still there, still running it, so I will get the benefit of their enthusiasm, experience, knowledge. I will want to know as much about his or her life and associated madnesses as about their museum's contents. I plan to avoid the famous ones, the national museums and galleries we all know and are so proud of, which attract millions of visitors every year. We do have some of the best, most magnificent on the planet, with the British Museum attracting 6 million visitors in a year. I also aim to miss out the big municipal museums, as they tend, on the whole, to cover a variety of topics. In many cases, They were indeed begun by an individual collector many decades ago, but have been added to by donations, gifts and acquisitions. Inside many of these local museums, there are mad exhibitions, dopey little collections, many of them fascinating. But I am looking for single-issue, stand-alone museums devoted to just one thing. I certainly am not looking for visitor experiences, for audio-visual excitements, for technological wonders, for interactive displays and amusements. Dear God, I'll run a mile from all those. I don't want state-of-the-art, but dusty, old, real objects, and if possible, to be able to touch and smell them. Nor do I want corporate exhibitions, even if they are free, PR exercises put on by dodgy industries to show us how caring they are. And I'll be avoiding exhibitions that are purely commercial, created to bring in paying punters, that are little more than theme parks or part of some bigger franchise or entertainment conglomerate. The museums I'm looking for must be amateur, modest, low-tech affairs, many of which will probably turn out to be hidden away in back rooms, holes in walls, converted shops and warehouses, rarely ever professionally designed museum spaces. In these sorts of places, I don't expect queues, bossy attendants ordering you to move around in a certain order at a certain time. I am sure I will be mostly left to my own devices, to wander round, to ponder and wonder, not always being able to find the madman, I mean inspiration, behind it all. Mad museums represent a very quirky way of life, very British, I was about to say, but America and Europe also have their share of the daft, the eccentric, the obsessive. I expect among the museum creators and curators to find kindred spirits. Or will I? Will they be as different as their collections, as different as their own differing life stories and motivations? They might be a dreadful warning to me. Or perhaps they will prove an inspiration, and that old fantasy about opening my own museum will pop into my head again. Oh yes, it's still there. But will my journey round the mad museums be the end of it? Chapter 1. The Fan Museum, Greenwich. I'm not sure why I decided to begin with fans. I know nothing at all about them, have never had any interest in them. Perhaps that was part of the attraction. If you think you know something about a subject, even just a little, or have some similar stuff yourself, then you have a tendency to go round saying, "Oh, I've seen that, I've got this, thought they would have had that." I like to think I can understand and appreciate why anyone collects anything, without knowing much about the object itself. But this would be a test, to see if something I'm totally ignorant about can engage and stimulate and fascinate. Anyway, everyone knows what a fan looks like, don't they? It's fan-shaped, isn't it? It also sounded a classic one-subject museum, devoted to one finite topic, not mixed up with other similar subjects. It was begun by the person who is still running it, so that was an extra vital plus. And it did seem sensible to start in London before fanning out around the country. And I fancied going to Greenwich again. Quite an adventure for someone living in North London who normally never goes south of the river, if it is south of the river. I never get the bends right once the Thames starts messing around, doubling back on itself. It did feel quite exotic, as if I had arrived abroad, especially coming on the Docklands Light Railway, a wonderful relief after the horrors of the Northern Line. It was a sunny summer's day with lots of tourists around, for Greenwich is a tourist trap, with the Maritime Museum and the park and all that, yet it somehow didn't feel touristy or honeypottish. Greenwich is not Blackpool or Brighton. It is too classy to lower its skirts, wiggle its hips, give unnecessary come-hither winks and nudges. It has also attracted some grand, classy people over the years. I was last here, let me think, 40 years ago, when I came to interview Cecil Day Lewis, who was then the poet laureate, married to the actress Jill Balkan. Their son, Daniel Day Lewis, must have been about 12 or 13 the day I went to their house, but I don't remember him. I do remember their grand Georgian house was in Croom's Hill, perhaps the best address in all Greenwich, which is where the Fan Museum happens to be situated. Another reason for wanting to see it. Helene Alexander herself came to the front door of the museum, which I could see was in fact two Georgian gems, a matching pair, formed into one even grander piece of architectural jewellery. She herself is rather grand, not tall but very stately, aristocratic even, and sometimes talks of herself as one, with a slightly foreign accent which I couldn't place at first, one of those European ladies of a certain age and era, well-travelled, highly cultured, used to staff, telling others what to do, but with great courtesy and politeness. She was on the reception desk, as her other member of staff that day had gone for lunch, selling the tickets, answering the phone. "Fan Museum," she said, enunciating every letter. She didn't give her name, or reveal that she was the director, that it was her museum, containing 4,000 fans, so the museum leaflet states, many of which she herself has collected, the only dedicated fan museum in the world. How did she begin? How does anybody begin collecting anything? The idea of 4,000 of them, though, that was a bit difficult to take in or even believe. Different fans? Surely not. Surely there are only, let me see, a few hundred actually different ones in the whole world. But even while still half thinking this silly thought, I corrected myself. As a collector, I know you can have as many items in your collection as you can collect. I wandered round on my own, while she attended to members of the public who arrived in dribs and drabs. They mainly seemed to be single women in their 40s, who stood in reverence before each case. There was a hush and seriousness to the Fan Museum, a feeling of academia, not the amateur, scruffy hobbyishness of my own dear collections. Then a Cockney family, couple and teenage daughter, arrived, paid their money and stood looking, wondering where to begin. The mother and her daughter went over together to a glass case, oohing and aahing at a case full of fans, while the father remained at the doorway. "Too girly for you, is it?" said the mother, smiling sideways at her daughter. "What do you mean?" replied the man. "I mean, are you not coming in?" "I'm reading this," he said, pointing to a long introductory notice in the doorway. "As you're supposed to." He was right. And she was right. In theory, in most museums there is an order, picture storyboards perhaps, which explain the background and introduce you to what you are about to see, or just some blunt arrows bossing you the correct way, directing you from case to case, room to room. If, of course, you can see them. Usually I find myself, like the women, going to the first thing that looks interesting, only later realising there has been a plan, a carefully worked out arrangement, which afterwards I might go back and follow, or not. I was waiting for Mrs. Alexander. When her assistant had relieved her, she led me into a lift. That was a surprise. You don't expect lifts in a Georgian gem. To her office, where she called another member of her staff to make some tea, if he could be so kind, which then appeared in perfect little china cups. Helene was born in Alexandria, in Egypt, in 1932, one of four daughters of a wealthy Jewish-Egyptian landowner and gentleman farmer, Victor Adder. They had an English nanny and lots of staff. Every summer, her mother and father would set sail for 3 months in Europe, taking their grandmother, aunts, plus all the daughters and nanny. It was really a caravanserai when we set off, with so many people, so much luggage. We would go to Venice, where Mummy bought her table linen. We'd go to Florence, where Mummy always got her underwear. In Paris, Granny bought her hats. In London, we bought children's clothes, and my father would go to see his chums at the British Museum. I remember a Mr. Baldwin, whose relations, I think, are still connected with the numismatic department. Hélène's father was a world-renowned collector of coins, specializing in the Roman and Ptolemaic periods. He also collected paintings, as did several other members of his family, but coins were his first love. As a little girl, Hélène did collect, but just dolls. She had a large doll's house and filled it with dolls of all the nations, brought back by relations or acquired when she herself was on her grand tour with her papa. She was eventually sent to the French Lycée in Alexandria, where she learned fluent French, having already learned Italian. Then, in the early 1950s, she came to London to learn theatre design at the Central School of Arts and Crafts, going on to study for a degree in art history at the University of London. My money ran out during my studies, so I had to complete my degree at night classes. I did some work as a teacher, helping young ladies to get finished by teaching them about art. In London, during the Suez Crisis, as an Egyptian I was looked upon as an alien, despite being Jewish, which wasn't very pleasant. In 1958, she was married to A.V. Alexander Dickey, whom she had first met on a family holiday in Scotland. He had gone off from Cambridge to do his national service, and then become a successful insurance broker in the city. I knew him all my life. Growing up, I used to meet him in Cairo, as his father was an international lawyer who worked in Cairo for a while. It was a coincidence, I suppose, always meeting him, and of course even more so that he was called Alexander, the name of the place where I was born. It must have been meant. They lost 2 children as babies, one after the other, which was a terrible tragedy. But then later they had a daughter, Susanna. Hélène took a job, unpaid, as a volunteer at the V&A, where she worked for 13 years in the textile department, eventually as assistant to the keeper of textiles, picking up a knowledge of the history of dress and of accessories. From my studies of the history of art, I had always been interested in dress and design, so I knew quite a lot about it anyway. I was particularly interested in underclothes and corsets and in fans. She didn't at first collect fans, though she had been stage-struck with her grandmother, who used them. She had been a lady-in-waiting to a sultana. She had a big black ostrich feather fan, for she was in semi-mourning most of her life. It was only about 1963 that I started properly studying and collecting fans. My husband always used to say that the fans were my escape from thinking about my lost daughters, a distraction from the tragedy. I don't know. I wasn't aware of it, but I suppose it could have been some sort of sublimation. I was never an obsessive collector. I'm still not. It never took over my whole life. It was just an interest. What I was interested in was learning about the whole history of fans, so of course I collected them because I wanted to study them. But even then I would have to say it was only an occasional pastime, not every day. Her husband Dicky encouraged her, pleased to see her interested and occupied. He himself was not a collector, though he had a few rather rare 18th-century seals, the sort that aristocrats used to seal their letters. When I first decided to start collecting fans, I told my father about it, and I remember him giving me one piece of advice. Whatever you collect, you must try to be more knowledgeable than the expert. It was good wisdom, for he knew more about the coins he collected than anyone else. From the beginning, I always made it my business to learn everything I could about fans. She says she didn't spend a great deal of money on her fans, as she and her husband were not really wealthy. But she did begin to attend all the West End auction houses whenever there were fans being sold. "Often I would buy a job lot for £30, an assortment of different fans, perhaps 10, one or two of which I wanted, as I had viewed them beforehand. The ones I didn't want, I would put back into another sale. Of course, at that time I would never buy anything blind, just from a catalogue. How unwise that would have been." When I became a born-again collector and decided to get back into stamps, I did that all the time, bidding for lots without looking or even understanding what was in them. I enjoyed the surprise, opening mystery packets I'd forgotten about, even when I ended up with doubles, with stuff I didn't want or total rubbish, which of course was very, very stupid. I asked her if she began to meet and make friends with other fan collectors once she started going to sales, which is what often happened to me.
"Not really. Collectors are very private, secretive, suspicious people. Some see other collectors as rivals."
"That's not been my experience," I said, "at least not at my humble level. Once I've displayed some minimum knowledge, I've always found other collectors more than keen to share their expertise and show off their own treasures."
"Perhaps it's just fan collectors. They, of course, are the ones I know. We really are very private people. We seldom reveal what we have. We're not as bad as dollies, collectors of dolls. They can be really vicious." "No, I shouldn't have said that. Let's just say some of them can be sometimes."
When she started going for better class fans, at places like Christie's and Sotheby's, she began to use a rep to do her bidding, telling her what price to go up to and not beyond, having personally inspected the fans to be sure of their authenticity.
"This started a very productive relationship with a most clever person who became a true friend."
But wouldn't her presence, once she had been spotted at the auction as a known collector, have put off other bidders, who might have given up and she would have got a better price?
"On the contrary, my presence would have alerted them to something unusual and valuable, and I do not enjoy competition. I was becoming a world expert on fans, so they would have kept bidding longer than they might have done otherwise."
"To capture an overlooked treasure, or just to outdo you?"
"Both," she replied. "But I suppose the main reason was that I wanted to remain private, which many fan collectors do. Today, here in the museum, I often have members of the public coming in who bring a fan with them. They ask me about it, all rather hesitant and nervous, saying it has got broken, wanting to know how it can be mended. While I'm looking at it, I ask them about themselves. Very often they make several visits, and it's only then I discover that they have their own collection, sometimes very good ones. They have not told me about it because they've wanted to keep it a secret."
All the same, she did make friends with another fan collector who happened to live not far from herself and her husband in Blackheath.
"This man said that he and others wanted to start a fan circle for fan collectors, and they asked me to become the first president. I then contributed some of my fans to an exhibition which was being held at Preston Art Gallery. I'm not sure how that came about, but they had been left a collection of fans which belonged to the Countess of Ross, Lord Snowdon's mother, which were also on show. Collecting fans began in the late 19th century, at least in Britain, and it was popular amongst many aristocratic ladies. When they died, their collections were usually handed over to some museum or gallery, as the next generation were not really interested. That's why both the British Museum and the V&A have some very important fan collections. Not that you would know, as they're not on show."
The idea for a museum in which to display her own collection did not come to her till 1984, and it was sparked off by the fact that her late father's coin collection was to be sold at Christie's.
"I knew that my sisters and I would each be getting some money, and I did wonder what I might do with any inheritance. One idea was that my husband and I would buy a little country cottage somewhere, and I could use one room to display my fans. My husband said, "No, you must do it properly or not do it at all. You must create a proper museum, and it must be in London."
The search for the right location took several years and lots of missed opportunities in various parts of London. She had decided she wanted it to be near a major national museum, but not one that covered fans, so as not to be in competition, more in association. She eventually picked Greenwich for its maritime museum, and because it was an area she knew living in Blackheath. She heard about two adjoining Georgian houses coming up for auction in Croom's Hill, but they were in very bad condition. They had been council-owned, run as a nurse's home, but for many years had lain derelict. On her first visit, pigeons flew out of the front door, and all she could see was a dark hole. She didn't go to the auction herself in December 1985, as she couldn't bear to lose the properties, having set her heart on them. She sent her husband, who bid successfully but had to pay more than they had agreed. The official owner of the building became the Victor Adder Foundation, the trust established by her father, which then handed the premises over on a 999-year lease to the Fan Museum, which she set up as an independent educational charity. "How much did you have to pay," I asked, "for two wrecked Georgian gems back in 1985?
"Maybe it was £330,000. "Yes, that was it. My memory is not what it was for those sorts of financial facts."
But she does remember that they spent over £1 million making the houses safe, then converting them for use as a museum. The work took 7 years, far longer than they had expected, what with building problems, planning permissions, and opposition from various local residents.
"It still goes on, whenever we want to do anything. You would think a fan museum must be encouraging drunks and hooligans and all-night parties from the way some people are always complaining and objecting."
They vastly overran the budget, which the foundation had agreed, though they never got into debt, but had to apply to various bodies like the National Lottery and city institutions, helped by her husband's contacts. One of her sponsors is Canon, the Japanese camera company.
"When you go out into the back garden, you will see our Japanese garden. I promised them the money would go to something with a Japanese flavour."
So she is not as financially vague as she might like to appear. She handed over her own collection of some 2,000 fans to the museum, and they make up the core collection. But she also got donations or long-term gifts from other collectors, especially the Fan Association of North America. The Fan Museum opened its doors in 1991 and proved an immediate success, attracting a lot of enthusiastic visitors, and since then it has won many awards. And so it should. The setting is splendid, the displays beautifully arranged and explained, and of course, the contents are world class. In 2009, Prince Charles's wife, Camilla, Duchess of Cornwall, became a patron, which was quite a coup. The Duchess's staff wanted to give her a gift and applied to the Worshipful Company of Fan Makers, still an important and wealthy livery body in the city, of which Hélène is an honorary liveryman.
"The Duchess's secretary came here to look at our fans, and we suggested the design for one that could be made for her, which we did. After that, the Duchess herself made a visit and agreed to be our patron."
In 2009, Hélène became an MBE. Yet despite royal patronage, all the awards, and its fame in fan circles worldwide, the museum averages only between 8 and 10,000 visitors a year. I'd expected more, given its excellent situation. Even more disappointing, after almost 20 years, the museum is not yet self-supporting.
"I pay for the insurance of my own fans, and we try hard to raise money through the shop and through fan classes and lectures, and hiring out the orangery for private parties. Despite all this, we still have to rely on grants from people like the Tourist Board and from the Victor Adder Foundation, just to keep us going. It would be nice to be self-financing, but we are still not there yet.
Her husband died in 1999, and now in her late 70s, she feels she does not have the energy she once had.
When my husband was alive, we used to organize big gala parties, and they used to encourage generous donations. My husband was at Cambridge with Mrs. Runcie, whose husband was Archbishop of Canterbury. She organized a fundraising concert at Lambeth Palace. I want the museum to go on forever, in perpetuity, and be a seat of learning and excellence. So it has taken some heart-searching not to go down the path of vulgar tourism. I don't want to make it just another slick attraction for the kiddies. In these 20 years, all who come here have been enchanted. Only twice have we had a negative comment in the visitor's book.
And what was that, pray?
Oh, some person complained that they had expected to see 4,000 fans actually on display all the time, which, of course, was a ridiculous moan. How could we be expected to do that?
She is determined the museum will continue, and has made plans for its financial future. But the problem of finding someone with similar knowledge is a real one.
When I go, they will need 3 people.
The world of fan collecting, apparently, is rather in the doldrums. There are some very keen collectors out there, and big prices get paid for choice items. Up to £300,000 for a fan hand-painted by, say, a famous impressionist, or £50,000 for a fan with inlaid jewels. But the prices of ordinary fans, however ancient, are fairly stationary. So much so that the specialist fan sales, which places like Christie's used to hold once or twice a year when Hélène first started collecting, have now ceased.
They can't get the experts. That's one of the problems. The knowledge has been lost. The departments where people learned about fans have been closed. There are hardly any full-time dedicated fan dealers now in Britain at all.
France appears to be the main centre of fan research, and there are still a couple of fan dealers in Paris, and some learned French experts and fan makers. However, the fan circle in Britain soon became the Fan Circle International, which has about 300 members, so all is not lost. Most fan collectors are women, but there are some men, drawn into it by the theatrical and dress connections.
The one good bit of news is the Russians. They are suddenly becoming interested in fans, especially ones from their own culture, and they have a lot of money.
I began my tour downstairs, as one should, as that is where she has arranged the permanent exhibitions. Having talked to Hélène first and learned about her background, I felt slightly better equipped to understand and appreciate the treasures. It's not, of course, how normal punters approach a museum, but I made a note to myself always to try, where possible, to see the museum creator before seeing their creation. The ground floor seemed to be a mass of glass cases and cabinets, the contents all immaculately displayed, with extensive labels and explanations, but somehow a bit daunting and sort of complicated, despite telling myself I now knew a bit about fans. Wandering round, though, several times, and then starting in the proper order as directed, it all began to make sense. As with so many things that appear at first sight rather limited in appeal and importance, when choice, rare objects are properly presented and properly explained, one does begin to realise that fans are a rich subject with many varied uses. I hadn't, till then, been aware of just how many uses there have been for fans over the centuries. Firstly, they were important as a cooling device, especially in tropical or hot countries, before the world got round to air conditioning. They could keep the flies away from bodies or animals. They could be used to fan flames, to keep fires going, to create a wind, to separate wheat from chaff. They had a role in religious and ceremonial and regal occasions. They were cultural and decorative objects, painted to depict historical scenes and events. They've also been used as advertising boards, to sell products or carry messages. When you think about it, which of course I'd never done before, fans are multi-purpose objects. whose history can be traced back several thousand years. They appear in ancient Egypt, for example in the tomb of Tutankhamun, and were used in antiquity by the Etruscans, Greeks, and Romans. The word fan, so Hélène told me, comes originally from vanus, the Latin for winnowing. The French word for fan, eventail, and the Italian, ventaglio, have a similar derivation, from the word for wind. Though, when I later looked up the English word fan in my Chambers dictionary, it says it comes from the Anglo-Saxon F-A-N-N. No doubt the Anglo-Saxons borrowed it from the Romans. Fan, as in football fan, comes of course from fanatic, and it first appeared with that meaning in the 17th century. Thinking about fans for the first time in my life, and looking at the Roman examples in the museum, it suddenly struck me that for about 40 years I've had an ancient fan staring at me every day. On my desk, I have a small statue that I bought at the Tully House Museum in Carlisle. It's a copy of a tombstone found locally and dating from around the 2nd century AD, which shows a lady, a child at her side, who is clearly holding a large fan in her right hand. Why would she need that in Cumbria? It wasn't exactly tropical even all those centuries ago. I now realise it must have been ceremonial, presumably to depict her status. In the fan museum, no flashlights are allowed near the fans, and all the windows have UV filters. The electric lights are monitored, and the temperature carefully controlled. Fans are quite delicate objects, though all the ones in the cabinets seemed in splendid condition, even the oldest ones, dating back to the 11th century. Mostly, they seem to be from the 17th to 19th centuries. Most fans do appear to be fan-shaped, like a half-circle, made so they can be folded with or without handles, but they can also be flat. The variations are enormous. They can be totally round, with a long handle, or made of straw, or very large for the fanning of some important personage. They can be made of highly coloured feathers, often large ostrich feathers. As for the handles, they were often highly decorated with gold leaf, hand-painted or enamelled. The main part of a fan is called the leaf, and is usually made of paper, silk or some cotton material that has been laid out flat. The stick and the vertebrae, the skeleton of the fan, is known as the monture. There is a glossary on the wall explaining all the terms, most of which are French, traditionally the world leader in the making of fans. It was the Italians in the 15th century who are credited with popularising the folding fan, but it was the French who took over as the experts. Queen Elizabeth I brought fans into vogue in England and used both fixed and folding ones. Their popularity led to the formation of the Worshipful Company of Fan Makers in 1709. Queen Victoria was very keen on them and sponsored an exhibition in 1871. Art schools all over the UK were encouraged to enter examples and win prizes, in the hope that British fans would catch up with the French, but they never acquired the same status. Today, there is no fan making in the UK. The ground floor of the museum serves as an introduction to fans and contains the most interesting examples, taking you through their manufacture and design, explaining their history and art. It is incredibly detailed and well displayed, but often I found my head going dizzy, trying to take in all the terms, understand the different types, materials, significance. I was in a daze of incomprehension, mostly. I might just as well have been trying to learn calculus or Chinese. My little brain didn't seem up to the intellectual effort required. However, there are quite a few exhibits that are easy to appreciate, such as a fan leaf painted by Gauguin in 1887, showing a scene in Martinique, and also one by Sickert. The Impressionists were very keen on fans, painting them as presents for friends and admirers. There are also some novelty fans, including a telescopic fan that expands and contracts, one that holds an ear trumpet, another a pair of spectacles. One is described as a Swiss army knife for corseted ladies, and contains, secreted away, a miniature sewing kit so emergency repairs could be undertaken. There is a Welsh fan made of Welsh slate, and some naughty ones, with traditional scenes on one side but erotic or saucy pictures on the other. Upstairs, there is always a special exhibition, which changes every 4 months. The day I was there, it was the Adam and Eve exhibition, with fans depicting biblical scenes and characters. There are at least 3 mentions of fans in the Bible, but of course, thousands of fans on which biblical scenes have been illustrated. The exhibition had its own very erudite catalogue, some 34 pages, giving detailed descriptions of each of the 73 biblical fans on show. Over the years, other special exhibitions have been devoted to children in fans, theatrical fans, advertising fans, and many other topics. I found it amazing that Hélène has managed to mount 3 different exhibitions on different topics every year for the almost 20 years during which the museum has been open. I was later allowed into the library or study, a large drawing room on the first floor, not open to the public but available for scholars and researchers. Hélène was working away on her next exhibition, which was to be on military fans. She slid open various cunning drawers to show me some of the examples she was going to display. The room is filled on all sides with specially built sets of walnut veneered drawers, made with a little silver fan at the top of each row, each with a different letter, so the fans can be easily located. This is where the majority of the museum's 4,000 fans are stored, kept carefully in the drawers, wrapped in tissue paper. The garden and the orangery, which several times a week serves teas, are also immaculate. The walls of the orangery are covered with hand-painted murals. Outside, the front half of the garden is in the shape of a fan, while behind, there is that Japanese-style garden. It is all in exquisite taste, and reeks not just of refinement and scholarship, but of affluence. No expense seems to have been spared. No wonder the museum does not make a profit. It does have an academic, learned feeling to it, and has been most professionally created and organized. I wondered if I would see another such clearly high-class, upmarket museum on my travels. I suppose I half expected something a bit more amateur and informal, which is what I would probably end up with if I ever opened my own museum. I do tend to be a messy collector, which is how I feel most collectors are, caught up in the excitement of their passion. Hélène didn't strike me as a messy person. And her reason for beginning her collection in the first place, with the loss of her daughters, was one I had never imagined. So, that was one thing I had learned, that I don't know what I don't know, that I can't possibly guess at all the reasons that might make people begin their own museums. There was nothing I particularly envied in her museum, no object I coveted, nothing I longed to take away and hug, and, despite being so impressed, I wasn't inspired to start collecting fans for myself. My little brain and my little house are full of enough clutter. But goodness, I did so admire what she had done and how she had done it. Creating such a wonderful space out of 2 derelict houses. The thing I'd most like to spirit away would be Hélène herself, to assist me, if and when I ever get round to starting my own museum, to help knock it and me into shape. I went back to say farewell to Hélène and told her how much I admired what she had done. I felt in awe of what she had created. It made all my little collections seem piddling. And it had also let me see that there can be many reasons and motivations for creating a museum. It was such an achievement, a work of art and scholarship, knowledge and devotion, all on one subject, yet vast and rich in range and content. It represents over 40 years of her life, devoted to the study and collection of fans. The result, I said, of a totally magnificent obsession. Sorry, just slipped out. I must not, she told me once again, describe her as an obsessive. That's not how she sees herself. She does veer between pride, almost a superiority, in her knowledge and in the richness of collection, and coolness and detachment, as if above it all, removed from all such material possessions. I am not an obsessive, because I know too much about the world, and I know that things are not as important as people. The fans took over my work, but not my life or being. If my daughters had lived, I am quite sure I would have never created this museum. Her two daughters had died as babies, but she did not want to go into the details, even after all these years. But that is why I have always known that an object is just an object, while a person is always a person. The Fan Museum, 12 Croom's Hill, Greenwich, London SE10, 8ER. Telephone 020-8858-7879. www.fan-museum.org. Chapter 2. The Vintage Wireless Museum, Dulwich. The British Vintage Wireless and Television Museum is one of those unique places, world-famous in wireless circles, but set in an ordinary suburban house, and hellish to find. The Fan Museum is in a house, but one beautifully and professionally converted into a museum, well signposted and in a very well-known street. The Vintage Wireless Museum was in a house that was still lived in by its creator, and sounded to be a rather eccentric, messy museum. Just the sort of place I felt sure I would love and identify with, even though, yet again, I was coming to a subject about which I knew nothing. Over the years, so I gathered, it had grown to 13 rooms, totally devoted to the wonderful world of wireless, filled with 1,500 different wireless and TV items, so you'd think it would be easy to find, or at least that the neighbours would be able to point it out. It is one of those by-appointment-only museums, which is often the case with the more esoteric places. Its founder and curator, Gerald Wells, is getting on a bit. He's now 80 years old, and doesn't want folks just turning up. You have to ring and book. I did find him on Google, in deepest Dulwich, with an address and telephone number. I eventually got through to him on the phone, which was lucky, as he doesn't always answer, being far too busy. But he agreed to see me next Friday morning. Not too early, say about 10:30, he'd have the kettle on ready. I then asked how to get to his house. "No idea," he said. "But what about the nearest tube station?"
"There isn't one."
"Railway station?"
"Not the foggiest. I don't use trains."
"Buses?"
"I wouldn't know. I don't go out."
"Thanks," I said. "See you then, I hope." From the map, his address appeared to be in West Dulwich, but I worked out that Tulse Hill, a place I'd never been to and thought might be fictional, was the nearest railway station. When I got there, I spotted a minicab office in the street outside. A driver took me straight to the address in Rosendale Road, and was absolutely amazed that there was a world-famous museum inside. First he'd heard of it. The front garden of the house, a two-storey brick-built detached villa, appeared a bit neglected. Mr. Wells himself eventually opened the front door, wearing a rather dirty-looking white coat, the sort young doctors wear, which had clearly seen better days, and holding on to his walking stick. Rather tall and bulky, spectacles, quite well-spoken, if a little bit croaky and creaky. He had been ill, he said. In fact, he'd been very ill many times in the last few decades. In fact, he's surprised he's still here. He is unmarried, and has always lived alone, which is just as well, for from the moment you enter, the whole house is covered with old radios, or bits of old radios. He led the way into his kitchen, which didn't look as if it had been touched since the 1950s, linoleum on the floor, ancient sink and cooker, sensible-looking dark brown china teapot in which he made tea. He was born in 1929 in this